I'm going to do something a little bit different tonight. In fact, I think what I'm going to do for many of you will be fun. Some of you, it may not be as big of a deal because if you don't love history as much or touching items out of history. Most of what I've brought tonight is not part of the Black Robe presentation. So there are just a couple of pieces or so that are from that presentation that I don't think all of you have seen. Some of them are relatively new to our collection. But the other things are from different periods of time. And many of you have asked, well, Dan, do you collect this? Do you collect that? Well, you're going to see some of the stuff that I collect. But here's what I want to do. I want to dedicate tonight's kind of almost like show and tell, Brian. You asked me a while ago. I want to dedicate tonight's kind of show and tell study to our veterans. So if you are a veteran, this past Sunday, we had Dr. Jay Lee here. We had so many other things going. To be honest with you, we just kind of let Veterans Day fly right over our heads. We typically never do that, so we're not going to do that this Sunday. We'll take care of that. But today is Veterans Day, so we want to honor. So those of you who are veterans, would you please stand? All of you who are veterans, God, thank you. God bless you. Thank you so much for your service. Thank you. You can be seated. Well, what I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to talk about the importance of our veterans and our history and kind of blend all that together. And as Christians, enjoy our history and kind of hear some really neat stories of some items that I have here that I can actually tell the story about that were there and did that, which is kind of cool. And then we're going to kind of let everybody see all these and hold them because I want you to be able to hold these items. And many of them you've not seen before because I haven't had them here. And they go all the way from the War of Independence all the way up through World War II. So that's what we're going to be looking at tonight. Well, first of all, the Bible says that we should render, therefore, to all their due. Taxes to whom taxes are due. And I have found that that doesn't take any discipline on your part because they'll make sure that you pay your taxes. Customs to whom customs. Once again, they'll pretty much make sure that you do that. Fear to whom fear. Now it's becoming volitional. But this is the part that I wanted to emphasize. Honor to whom honor is due. And tonight we owe a great debt of honor and respect to all of our veterans. Those of you obviously who are in this room, those who are not, and we just want to tell you that we love you, and we appreciate you, and I know that we just kind of do this once a year. Of course, there are numerous patriotic days on our calendar, and we tend to try to honor everyone. Memorial Day is more about those who've died in service. Veterans is more about all those who've been in our service. 4th of July, of course, is Independence Day, and so we typically kind of try to honor everybody through all of those. But today especially, I want to tell you how much I appreciate your service. My dad was a drill sergeant in the Army, and so I kind of grew up with that drill sergeant's atmosphere. And if you remember Gomer Pyle and Sergeant Carter, we'd move it, move it, move it. Well, that was kind of the way it was at our house when we were growing up. But I so respect all of you for your service, and I want to thank you. Now, see, I'm one who believes that everything that a Christian does is spiritual. Paul has often talked about compartmentalization. I've been talking about that for years, how in America we've developed this idea that we have a secular life, we have a spiritual life, and you don't mix the two. That's completely foreign to Scripture. It's foreign to most of our history. Most Christians never thought that way in America. That's only from the 20th into the 21st century. Before that, Christians believed that everything was spiritual. So see, I believe that our patriotism, our understanding and love for history, our service to our country, all of that is spiritual. I believe it is. I don't believe that it's secular. I don't believe that it's just patriotic, although it is patriotic. I believe it's spiritual. So for me, history has always had a connection for me, and it goes beyond just plain old history, and it goes into who I am, why I'm here, those who have come before me, the sacrifices that have been made, the effort that has been put forth so that I can have the liberty to carry out my ministry as God has called me without fear of the government putting external pressure on me. Now, unfortunately, in my lifetime, I've seen that begin to change, which is very sad, right? But for most of my life, that's the way it's been. And so for me, history has an immediate connection into the present, and then we'll travel into the future. Remember that to God, everything is now. He is the great I am, not the I was, not the I will be, but the I am. Everything is now. God is outside of time. And so there's no such thing as yesterday, today, and tomorrow to those who are in heaven, to those who are beyond time. God created time, put us in it. We live in a time, space, matter continuum, right? Well, God is not limited to that. So God is the great I am. He is the transcendent one, theologians will often say. So for me, history is living. I realize that it was in the past, but it's living to me. And so some of these items that we're going to talk about help to bring that to life for me. And I believe if America saw history as alive, we wouldn't be making the dumb mistakes that we're making right now, because we would carry our history with us. See, that's one of our problems. We have written off our history as past tense. That's old stuff, doesn't matter anymore. I didn't care much for history in school anyway. Well, unfortunately, if you do that, then you're operating like a culture with amnesia. So you don't have a memory. What happens to an individual when they lose their memory? Well, they don't know who they are. They don't know where they came from. They don't know where they are. And they have no idea where they're headed because they have no memory. One of the dreaded diseases that we all hope that we never get is dementia and or Alzheimer's, right? Because we hate to see someone become disconnected from their history, because once you do that, you lose the present and obviously you lose the future. So for me, history is very, very important. So what I wanted to do to honor our veterans, because I'll bet you most of these veterans in this room will like all of this stuff. But we all should, to some degree or another, because of the history. But I wanted, first of all, to begin with George Washington in what I thought was very useful on Veterans Day, to hear what he was saying in his final order that he issued as Commander-in-Chief of the American Forces on April the 18th, 1783. The war is over. And listen to what he says. The Commander-in-Chief orders the cessation of hostilities between the United States of America and the King of Great Britain to be publicly proclaimed tomorrow at 12 o'clock at the new building, and that the proclamation, which shall be communicated herewith, be read tomorrow evening at the head of every regiment and corps of the army. After which, the chaplains with the several brigades will render thanks to the Almighty God for all his mercies. Now, for those who are always trying to say that George Washington was irreligious, or if he was religious, he was a deist, there is one piece of proof that he was not a deist. Remember, deists believe that God exists, made the universe, and then left it, and it has no interaction with us. Well, why in the world then would you want to give thanks to a God who's on vacation? See, you wouldn't. So Washington was not a deist. He goes on to say, particularly for his overruling the wrath of man to his own glory and causing the rage of war to cease amongst the nations. Now notice the pivotal role to Washington that chaplains play. This is part of the Black Robe Regiment message, these chaplains. So notice at the end of the war, he wants them to have services. He goes on to say, the Commander-in-Chief, far from endeavoring to stifle the feelings of joy in his own bosom, offers his most, thank you very much, sweetie, offers his most cordial congratulations on the occasion to all the officers of every denomination, to all the troops of the United States in general, and in particular to those gallant and persevering men who had resolved to defend the rights of their invaded country so long as the war should continue. Now here he's talking to the veterans. See, he's speaking to veterans on what I would call the very first Veterans Day. He's addressing the veterans, those who have fought. For these are the men who ought to be considered as the pride and boast of the American army, and who, crowned with well-earned laurels, may soon withdraw from the field of glory to the more tranquil walks of civil life. So here is George Washington, the father of our country, his last general order as Commander-in-Chief, asking Americans to celebrate, especially in the army, chaplains to have services the next day to thank God, and then he's thanking the veterans. So I just thought that that was very fitting that you would hear this. Now, to give you proof And this is kind of a little off the subject, but I think very useful to give you proof that Washington and many of those of his ilk were not godless or irreligious, didn't believe in God. I want you to listen to something that he said to General Nathanael Greene on February the 6th, 1783. If historiographers should be hardy enough to fill the page of history with the advantages that have been gained with unequal numbers on the part of America in the course of this contest, of course he's speaking of the war, and attempt to relate the distressing circumstances under which they have been obtained, it is more than probable that posterity will bestow on their labors the epithet and marks of fiction. For it will not be believed that such a force as Great Britain has employed for 8 years in this country could be baffled in their plan of subjugating it by numbers infinitely less, composed of men oftentimes half-starved, always in rags, without pay, and experiencing at times every species of distress which human nature is capable of undergoing. Now, I want you to listen to what he's saying. I'm going to put it in common language. He is saying to General Greene, when people hear how we won this war and the miracles that happened, they won't believe it. They'll think it's fiction. Now, a lot will say, well, he's just talking about the power of the military. Really? Listen to this. This is a letter to the governor and legislature of New Hampshire that he wrote in 1789. The success which has hitherto attended our united efforts, we owe to the gracious interposition of heaven. And to that interposition, let us gratefully ascribe the praise of victory and the blessings of peace. It sounds to me like a Christian talking there. This is Pastor Samuel Langdon. He was one of the Black Robe Regiment. He didn't go to the battlefield, but he certainly fanned the flames of liberty. And I want you to listen to what he said to him on September the 28th, 1789. So George Washington is writing to a pastor. The man must be bad indeed who can look upon the events of the American Revolution without feeling the warmest gratitude towards the great author of the universe whose divine interposition was so frequently manifested in our behalf. And it is my earnest prayer that we may so conduct ourselves as to merit a continuance of those blessings with which we have hitherto been favored. Once again, Washington is thanking God and giving God the credit for the victory to a pastor, Samuel Langdon. This is General Thomas Nelson Jr. Listen to what Washington wrote to him in 1778. It is not a little pleasing nor less wonderful to contemplate that after 2 years maneuvering and undergoing the strangest vicissitudes that perhaps ever attended any one contest since the creation, both armies are brought back to the very point they set out from, and that that which was the offending party in the beginning is now reduced to the use of the spade and pickaxe for defense. The hand of Providence has been so conspicuous in all this that he must be worse than an infidel that lacks faith and more than wicked that has not gratitude enough to acknowledge his obligations. But it will be time enough for me to turn preacher when my present appointment ceases, and therefore I shall add no more on the doctrine of Providence. Now here's George Washington once again celebrating what God has done. So here's what I want to do then. I want to tell you some stories, and I want to offer some things for you to hold in your hands to bring some of that history to life on this special day of Veterans Day in what I could not think of any better way to do it than items from those who have served in previous centuries to honor those of you who have served in previous decades. And so I thought that would be a fun thing to do tonight. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to begin with Samuel Gore. Now, typically in our Black Robe Museum, we have his traveling desk and all of the things that go with it. I only brought out one item other than a couple that you're going to see in just a second, because I wanted you to hear the story of Samuel Gore. Samuel Gore grew up in Boston. When he was 19 years of age, he was protesting outside the house of a Tory. Now, Samuel Gore's father, John Gore, was very active early on in liberty efforts, but then finally sided with the British and, because of shame and persecution, had to leave and go to Canada, Nova Scotia. So Samuel Gore and his siblings and his mother stayed behind, and they became great patriots. In fact, Samuel Gore participated in the Boston Tea Party. When you read the list of those who were on the ship throwing the tea overboard, you'll find his name. He was close friends with Samuel Adams. He was basically a part of the Sons of Liberty. So when he's 19, he was born in 1751. When he's 19, so this is 1770, he is standing outside the house of a Tory. Remember, the Tories are the Americans who sided with the British. They're protesting because they're wanting this Tory to know how displeased they are with him. He keeps trying to get them to leave. They won't leave. Finally, he comes outside and he fires his musket into the crowd. Well, he fires a load of what is called buck and ball. Now, there is a picture of a musket ball and three buckshot. I'll give you another advantage. This is buck and ball. So this would be wrapped in paper with powder in the paper. And when you fire this, the ball comes out last and it pushes these three buckshot forward like this. So it kind of spreads when it comes out the barrel. Okay? So this Tory fires that buckshot into the crowd and he hits an 11-year-old boy and kills him instantly. But he also hits Gore. Gore's been hit twice by two of these buckshot. Well, since Samuel Gore was so involved in the liberty effort and his family was so well-to-do, they knew Dr. Joseph Warren. He was the most famous doctor in Boston, but he was also the president of the Provincial Congress of Massachusetts. Now, what is the Provincial Congress? Well, it's the rebel Congress. They've put together a Congress in spite of the British Parliament and the King. He was also the highest ranking commander who was killed. And I don't know why that is there, because that is not supposed to be there. He was killed. We'll come back to that in just a second. He was killed at Bunker Hill. In fact, the painter Jonathan Trumbull, who painted the most famous painting of Bunker Hill, this is it, actually painted the moment. This is Dr. Warren right here as he was killed. That's when the Americans were retreating back over Bunker Hill because they had run out of ammunition, and the British had bayonets and the Americans didn't, and they couldn't fight them hand to hand, because if you don't have a bayonet and your opponent does, you're at a great disadvantage, right? So this is Dr. Warren. So Dr. Warren, they take Samuel Gore to Dr. Warren, and Dr. Warren removes the two buckshot from Samuel Gore. Well, we have Samuel Gore's desk. It has many personal items, and one of the items that I pulled out is his personal flintlock pistol. This was made in England. In fact, when you look at it tonight, it says London right here on top of the barrel. And then if you'll look right here on the plate, it has SG. That's Samuel Gore. So this is his flintlock pistol. But the gentleman, the collector that I bought this from, said one day he was digging through the desk and he happened to find a little wooden box that looked like a casket. And he thought, well, what is this? Because it has all kinds of little drawers in the desk. And so he pulls the little casket out. And so he opens the casket, which was actually hand-carved. And what he found inside the casket was the two buckshot that Dr. Joseph Warren had removed from the thigh of Samuel Gore. So these two little buckshot here were removed by Dr. Joseph Warren, and Samuel Gore had kept them in his little portable desk all of those years. Now, I'm going to take a real chance tonight, and I'm going to start passing these around. Please, with great care, do not lose those two buckshot, but you need to hold those in your hand. Now, there would have been three of those. One of them hit another man's pants and just put a hole in it, so he wasn't wounded. And then the ball obviously hit that 11-year-old boy that killed him. So as these come around to you, these are the buckshot. And I'm going to start the flintlock pistol on this side. Please, again, be very careful. These things are incredibly rare. But I want you to hold your history. So for me, this is an incredible story. So this is a veteran who fights for our independence and is killed at Bunker Hill, who as a physician removed those buckshot from Samuel Gore, who is the same as a veteran, who is one of the Sons of Liberty, and you're going to hold his flintlock pistol in your hands tonight, and you're going to hold the two buckshot that Joseph Warren held himself. To me, that is just pretty cool. I mean, you just don't get, if you like history, if you're a veteran and you like this kind of thing, it just doesn't get any better than this. Now, this is the plaque that was supposed to come up next. And I somehow flipped those slides. So I want to talk just a moment now about a different veteran. This man is a man by the name of Adam Miller. Adam Miller fought at the Battle of Oriskany, New York. As you can see, that battle was fought on August the 6th, 1777, around where modern-day Oriskany, New York is. Now, it was far less populated in those days, as you can imagine. And so they fought this battle. Now, they're fighting against British troops. There we go. The British troops. And the British troops have allied with the Iroquois Indians. So basically, the Americans are fighting Indians who are fighting guerrilla warfare style. This is a painting of what the Battle of Oriskany would have looked like. So notice, it's not in a big open field with the two armies lined up shoulder to shoulder, facing one another, firing volleys. They are fighting man to man, tree to tree. Well, during this battle, Adam Miller, an American soldier, a patriot, is captured. Now, here's what the British were doing. The British were taking POWs, or those that have been captured, the prisoners, and they were turning them over to the Iroquois. The Iroquois Indians were taking them outside the battlefield and torturing them to death. So here Adam Miller is being marched off to his death, very painful death, when one of the captains recognizes him, pulls out his flintlock pistol, very similar to the one you're going to hold in a moment, and shoots the British commander who's leading these prisoners off to their death. Well, when the British commander is shot and falls, Adam Miller breaks for it. And he runs away, he escapes, goes out onto the battlefield and picks this musket up, this one. This was not his original, he's lost his now. He goes out onto the battlefield and he picks this musket up. He begins to fight again when he notices that his commander has been captured, his captain. The way that they have captured his captain is they've taken two bayonets and driven one through each thigh and they've pinned him to the ground. And they're going to torture him to death. Adam Miller has to make a split-second decision. Am I going to go in there and try to save him and maybe meet the same fate, or am I going to just leave him to his fate and I'm going to keep on fighting? He takes this flintlock, turns it around, holds it by the barrel, and runs in there and brains a couple of those braves. In fact, there is a crack in the stock that very well could have been made when he did that, pulled the bayonets out of his captain's legs, dragged him to safety, and continued to fight the rest of the battle at the Battle of Oriskany. This is now his musket. It wasn't, but it is now, right? So sometime after the battle, he sits down, I would imagine it's August, under the shade of a tree, and he carves A. Miller, and then he carves Oriskany. Now, he carves it phonetically like the Indians would spell it. That's not the way you actually spell Oriskany, but it's phonetic, and you can make it out, 1777. So we know he carved this probably the same year. I would assume he carved it not long after the battle. Every time that I run my hands over that carving, I think of Adam Miller sitting somewhere under a tree, a great patriot who is one of those veterans that I owe my liberty to. And so I want you tonight to come up and hold this. I can't pass this around because it's so long, I'm thinking somebody get hit in the head. And if it's John, it'd be okay. But if it's anybody else, we don't want that to happen. But I want you tonight to hold this and look where Adam Miller, and I'm going to be hanging around here so that you can see all of this and you can know. Okay, Pam, also hand me this one real quick. I don't have a slide for this one. But I don't think I had this one here when I did the Black Robe presentation the last time. This musket was made by a deacon of the church in Concord, Massachusetts. Lexington, Concord. His name was Samuel Barrett. Right here at the top it says S. Barrett. His uncle, Colonel James Barrett, owned the farm on top of a hill that overlooked the old North Bridge. Today that's called Barrett Hill. And James Barrett's farm is now a museum. If you've ever been to Concord and you've gone to the old North Bridge, you've no doubt walked up there to Colonel Barrett's farm, which is now a museum. So this is his nephew, who's a deacon in the church at Concord. He's also a gun maker. He makes this gun. Jeremiah Kimball was a cabinet maker. Jeremiah Kimball was a member of the New Hampshire militia. Now, many of you can't see this, but you will later. It says NHM for New Hampshire Militia. He carved this scroll work in it with his name and wrote down some of the places that he fought during the war. And on this plate opposite the lock, it says Ticonderoga, 1776. So this musket not only has connections to Concord, Massachusetts and the Barrett family, but with a soldier from New Hampshire named Jeremiah Kimball, who carried this through the whole war. And this is probably our rarest and most valuable, incredible musket out of all that we have. Now, I've had people say, well, Dan, you really wanted to let people handle that? Well, think of it this way. It made it through that war in a couple of centuries. It's okay. It'll weather it. So tonight, when you hold these in just a moment, just consider the fact that they're incredibly rare because we know all the story behind them, and just hold them carefully. All right, now we're going to quantum leap 100 years. We're going to go to the war between North and South. And what I want to do is I want to talk about some items that I have here, most of them from Gettysburg, except for one. This is a Mississippi rifle, an 1841 Mississippi rifle. This was carried by a soldier from Tennessee named Edward Myrick. He was a member of the 1st Tennessee. That's actually a piece of artwork of a soldier from the artist's perspective as a member of the 1st Tennessee. He fought in Gettysburg on days 1 and 3, we think, but he was killed. But we don't know when during the battle, because the South didn't do their records till after a battle was complete. The Union Army did their records every day. So we don't know whether he was killed on day 1, because the 1st Tennessee fought on the first day's battlefield. They fought against the what is called the Iron Brigade. Now, if you've ever been to Gettysburg with me, we stood right there. But the Iron Brigade is the 24th Michigan. There's a painting of them. And Edward Myrick was fighting them with this Mississippi rifle. Not only do we have his Mississippi rifle, but we also have his pistol. It was not common for most infantry soldiers to have a pistol, so I would assume he picked this off of a battlefield before Gettysburg. And his initials, you can see them on the bottom of the pistol. Now, you probably can't see them from where you're seated, but it says EM. And if you look at the carving on the stock here and how he has put EM, it's the same handwriting. So this is his pistol that he carried at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and this is his Mississippi rifle. Now, he didn't make it out of Gettysburg. So either he was killed on day 1. Sadly, the 1st Tennessee was so beat up that they let them rest on July the 2nd. So remember, Gettysburg is July the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. But they needed soldiers so badly for what we call Pickett's Charge that they had the 1st Tennessee to join Pickett's Charge. And he could have very well participated in Pickett's Charge and was killed there. So another veteran who we have our existence for, even though he's fighting for the South, I'm from the South, and I appreciate the sacrifice, right? And so I want you to hold, obviously I got a bunch of stuff here, so I want you to hold this stuff, and I should have put this over here, Pam, so I'm sorry, I put it on the wrong table. Okay, now this is associated with this picture. This piece of artwork is a painting of the fighting on Culp's Hill, which is another part of Gettysburg. It would have been on the Union right, the Confederate left, as far as the lines are concerned. The reason why I have that picture up there is because this musket is an 1851 Springfield musket that was carried by George Dunlap from North Carolina. He was a member of Company I, 43rd Regiment, North Carolina. I took this musket with me a few years ago to Gettysburg, and I found the trenches where he and his men fought. And I figure that's the first time this musket had been back there since he had it there. So this is his musket. And on this side of the musket, you'll see where someone has tried to carve the initials out. But you can make out, if you look, GT for George T. Dunlap. And then over here it says Company I, 43rd Regiment, and then NC, North Carolina. His guys fought on day 1. And then they spent the rest of their time fighting some of the worst places at Gettysburg at Culp's Hill. So for me to hold this is amazing. Now there's a little neat piece with this. This is not the original ramrod, as you can see, because it sticks way out. So apparently he had lost his ramrod. And so he picks one up on the battlefield. But it's too long. So it sticks out here and it's got this big head on it. Well, if you look at it when you hold it, the bullet would strike it. So notice what he did. He bent it. He bent the ramrod so the bullet would clear the head of this ramrod when he fired it. Southern ingenuity, right? North Carolina. I want to hold this one up to you. This one is in a lot worse shape, but it'll hold together. It's fine. This is another soldier who was a member of the Tennessee regiments. His name was William Maynor, and he fought outside of Atlanta trying to stop Sherman's army. And this thing spent a lot of days out on the battlefield. So more than likely, he was either captured for a little while. He was not killed. He survived the war. Or he threw this one down for a more modern one, because this was actually a conversion. This one used to be a flintlock. And if you know anything about these, all of this is wrong for a modern percussion rifle of the Civil War era. So what this was conversion. The really interesting thing about it, and this old hammer is loose, is if those of you who are kind of gun aficionados will notice, at the very top of the hammer, there's a little groove cut. That's the rear sight. When you would cock it, you would turn it and look through the hammer and line it up with the sight at the end of the barrel. So somewhere outside of Atlanta, he lost this. And this is William Maynor. You can see he's carved his name here. But this is also carried by a Southern soldier. Now, I'm not sure the order of my picture. There we go. Okay, this is a very famous painting. It's actually part of what is called the Cyclorama, which is a painting in the round of Pickett's Charge. And when you go to Gettysburg, you want to go see this. And when I lead tours, this is what we do the first day. We go to the museum and then we go upstairs, and they have an incredible light and sound show that goes with us. So it's amazing. This piece of the painting is the place in Pickett's Charge that's called the High Water Mark. Now, the reason why I have this painting chosen is because this sword right here, if you'll look at it, is European. It almost looks like an old knight's sword, doesn't it? Well, this sword is in rough shape. But the reason it's in rough shape is because it laid on that battlefield for 27 years on the southern end. So we're looking at the painting. We're looking at this from the Union Army's perspective. So if you look back out this way, see the old house up in the corner of the screen? Okay, that is one of the farms. That's a Kadori farm where General Pickett actually watched the charge from. But if you go back beyond that, there's a line of trees that's called Seminary Ridge. See the trees? You can see that dark line of trees. Okay, that's Seminary Ridge. This was found over in those trees with an apple tree growing around it. And the people who found it actually donated it to a private, not a government, but a private museum. And for many years, it was in that museum at Gettysburg. And they actually painted on the blade the circumstances under which they had found it. They went out to pick herbs and found this sticking in an apple tree. And so they got permission from the farmer to cut the apple tree down, and they peeled the wood away. This sword had been dropped, no doubt, by a Confederate commander, because cavalry was not involved in Pickett's Charge, by a commander, who knows who. There's no name on it. You can see where the apple tree was growing through it, see where it rusted through. And it had laid on that battlefield for 27 years, and they found it. So some Southerner who didn't make it across the field at Pickett's Charge dropped this. So that's what this is. Now, I want to show you one more, and I'm not sure where my slides are, and then we're gonna do a quantum leap again. Yeah, let me back up here. Okay, I want to show you one more Gettysburg item. Now, this pistol was carried by a Union soldier. In fact, he was a sergeant of the New York 3rd Regiment. His name was John Coons, and you'll see that on the bottom. He was not at Gettysburg, but I brought it with me because this is a Remington, and it has some notches carved on the bottom of it. There's three notches cut into the wood and then his name. So when you hold it tonight, you'll want to look that over. The only thing I ask you to do when you're looking at these, don't try to cock them and fire them. Because the springs on these, some of them are so old that they'll snap. And so just don't be cocking them and firing them, even if they feel like they would. Please just refrain from doing that. But other than that, so I want you to, let me put this over here so we'll have a little more. I'm going to tell you about this sword that I'm waving around here. When you go to Gettysburg with me, we go to his grave and you hold this sword. This sword was carried by William Harris. His name is etched right here. William Harris was a Union soldier from West Virginia. He was cavalry. When Pickett's Charge was over, the Battle of Gettysburg was basically done, right? But they didn't know that. So what happens is the Union Army orders a cavalry unit under a commander named Kilpatrick to charge, be the Union left, to charge the soldiers, the Southern soldiers that had tried to take Little Round Top the day before. Well, these guys are entrenched. They're behind rocks and trees. They're fortified and they're ready. It was suicide. In fact, the commander said, "This is a suicidal mission. We should never do this. You don't take cavalry and have them charge at entrenched soldiers behind defenses." They ordered it anyway. It was a slaughter. Those Southern soldiers cut these guys down like crazy. William Harris was a lieutenant. He was killed in that charge. This is his sword. He is buried in the National Cemetery at Gettysburg. And so when we take tours there, we go to his grave and you hold his sword standing at his grave, who was killed on day 3, which would have been July 3rd, 1863, in what was a charge that should have never been ordered, but this is his sword, which is to me, once again, one of those tactile connections to my history. These are all veterans. See, it's men and women who have fought for us and made it so that we can be free. Now, here's what I want to do. I want to jump one more time, a quantum jump here, to the 1880s. Now, this is a picture of the surrender of Geronimo. On some of these pictures, you will see right here, see where that says C.S. Fly? Can most of you see that? C.S. Fly was the photographer in Tombstone, Arizona, whose studio was next door to the OK Corral. C.S. Fly went out to Skeleton Canyon. This was Arizona territory. Arizona was not a state yet. And he photographed the surrender of Geronimo and his Cherokee Apache band. These are the only pictures that we think are in existence of Cherokee Apaches still on the warpath. They haven't surrendered yet, but they're non-hostile because they've agreed to surrender. Now, the reason why I have this particular picture, obviously, there's Geronimo. Well, there were two brothers who were like his second in command. Perico and his brother named Fun, F-U-N, just like we'd say, had a fun time. This is Perico, this is Fun. Perico and Fun, I believe, were second cousins to Geronimo. Well, when they surrendered at Skeleton Canyon, you have probably seen pictures of this surrender, like this one, where they're standing on that ridge. Now, if you look, there stands Geronimo right there, and right there is Perico. Like I said, these are the only pictures that we think exist of the Apaches actually still on the warpath. So C.S. Fly is taking these pictures. Now, the reason why Perico is important, this is his carbine. On this side of the carbine, when you hold it tonight, you'll have to look very closely. But on this side, right next to the breech here, you'll see that the army engraved that it was captured by the Apache warrior, or captured from the Apache warrior Perico at the surrender of Geronimo at Skeleton Canyon, September the 4th, 1886, AT, which is Arizona Territory. They were taken once they surrendered to Fort Bowie. So if you'll notice in the stock here and stamped in the metal, you'll either see an FB or Fort Bowie. This was his rolling block Remington 4570. Now this one could be used today. That's how it works, right there. And they said that he was so good at this that he could put rounds between his fingers and his thumb and throw them in, push this back, fire it, do that again, and shoot it to where it sounded like he was using a repeater. That Perico was so good with this. Now, I let you, if you want to fire this, you can, because it's in perfect working order. This was his. This was used in the Indian Wars and was surrendered in 1886 at Skeleton Canyon by Perico himself. Now, there's something additional to Perico's story that I think you need to hear if I can get this remote to work. So we know now, Pam, it's not the remote. It's my computer. After he had been captured and they were taken to Florida, he's going to end up in Oklahoma. When the Spanish-American War breaks out, guess what Perico and many of his braves do? They join the American Army. There he is. There is Perico now as a U.S. soldier fighting in the Spanish-American War. He surrendered this in 1886. He's now an American soldier fighting for America. As I said, he was a soldier, and he ended up at Fort Sill, and that picture of him on the far left is him at Fort Sill, and by then he was Chief Perico, and he is buried there. Of course, Geronimo is too. They divided the Apache groups into different tribes, and they had Perico Village, and Perico died a chief and a veteran of the U.S. Army, having surrendered this carbine from the Indian Wars in 1886. Now, is that cool or what? I mean, that is way cool. And for a guy like me, who's kind of a history geek anyway, I mean, you just kind of can't, it's almost short circuit a little bit. Okay, want to talk about one more part of this, and I think my slides are done. Yeah. So here's what I want to do here to kind of wrap this up, and then I want you all to come and hold this stuff. We're going to quantum leap another 100 years. This is a 1942 M1 Garand. Now this, Dwight Eisenhower gave credit to be one of the two things that caused us to win the war. Does anybody know the second thing that he gave credit to? The Jeep. The Jeep, the Willis Jeep. He said it was the M1 Garand and the Willis Jeep because at the beginning of the war, we were using 1913 Springfields. Those are bolt action. Now you have this that has a bandolier with 8 shots that you shove down in here like that. It'll close just like that, and it's ready to go. And then you fire away. Now, all of these are empty. Please understand, now, most of these have never fired. I have not fired for 200 years, 150 years, so we're good. This one is completely empty. We've already checked it over and over and over, so you can feel safe with it tonight. This is the original issue, 1942 up to about 43 bayonet. They were much longer. And then you may be familiar with the shorter ones, which are almost identical, a little bit different. But I went ahead and put this on here so you could see how this would look. So this is 1942. And it has a serial number here where it was taken in and worked on because these soldiers, after battles, would turn them in. They'd take them in and work on them. That's why most of them, you can't find matching serial numbers because they've just been mixed and matched in the armory because they're just putting these things together to put them back out on to the battlefield. So this one is the Garand that everybody's always heard about. Let's see where I have the most room. Okay, this one is an M1 carbine. That one's a 30-06. This one's a 30 caliber. Now, this one was no doubt a bring home by one of the soldiers because if you look right here where the serial number is, it's been gouged out with something very sharp, more than likely a bayonet. So there is no serial number here. But this is an M1 carbine, and if you've ever shot one of those, now it's gonna push here. Just let me get out of here. This is the clip. If it'll come loose, there we go. Come out of there. Well, normally it just will pop right out. Here it is. I was pushing the wrong button. Paul and I have shot both of these. It's a lot of fun. But this one saw service, no doubt, probably in the European theater. And so this is an M1 carbine. A lot of the paratroopers use these because you can see they'd be a lot easier to jump with than the big long 30-06, the big Garand. And then I have one more item I want to show you that's maybe the coolest out of this whole World War II little collection is this. There's a woman who lives in Mustang, Oklahoma, whose father fought in the European theater. I got a call from a staff member one day. His father works with her. And he said, would Dan want to purchase a 1911 Colt that was used in Europe during World War II? And I said, duh. The problem was how much is it going to be? Because these are really expensive. She sold this to me for $700. And this was her father's. Now, why she wouldn't want to pass this down through the family, I do not know. This is the original holster that he carried this pistol with throughout World War II. This is a 1911 Colt, Army issue Colt. A 45 stinking Colt that was carried by a gentleman from Mustang, Oklahoma, through World War II in Europe. And I just think that's also really cool. Now, here's the reason I did this tonight. It's not because I'm just all about guns. For me, it was a way that I thought I could kind of honor the veterans and bring us all into the history of it. And so we can kind of touch and feel it tonight. So you have the opportunity here because we're going to pray and then we're going to go. I want to let you go early so that you have plenty of time. John, write this down somewhere, record it for posterity. But I want you to have enough time to hold these. Now, if you have children, you want them to hold them, that's good. Just please help them. Don't let them be waving these around by themselves because, you know, obviously they're pretty rare. With the long guns here, especially the two flintlocks, be very careful with them because they're much longer than you think they are. And I've nearly hit people in the head before at our museum when we're doing black robe deals. So don't brain someone. But I would encourage you, if you never have, put that to your shoulder and see what it looked like to fire a flintlock that is as long as some of you ladies are tall. And by the way, some of the women shot those. It's pretty amazing. Okay, does anybody have any questions before I kind of wrap us up with prayer and kind of why I did this? Because I think it's a big deal that you all who are in this room who are veterans served us and helped keep us free. Yes. No, we'll go into that another time. I just want to stick with these things. I'm so appreciative to you all for your service. And this is not much, but it was my little gift to you. So if you're a veteran, you make sure, in fact, when I dismiss us here in just a few minutes, I want the veterans to come first. Because I want the veterans, I'm not trying to be show favoritism, and yet I guess I am. So if you're a veteran, I want you to come first. If you want to hold these. Now, if you don't, that's fine. No problem at all. But I want everybody to be able to kind of hold this history. I'll be here to help you if you want to, if you have questions about it, and we can talk about them. But I think it's cool. And Scripture says, give honor to whom honor is due. And that's what I've tried to do here tonight in my little feeble way.